Sister Scarf. When you live there, it's safer that way. Anyway, you have to support your own. But is it not a game like Spillikins or Halma or Thud? No, it's more like war, but without the kindness and consideration. Oh, dear. But war is not kind, is it? Said Nut, bewilderment clouding his face. No. Oh, I see, you're being ironic. She gave him a sideways look. I might have been, she conceded. You are an odd one, Mr. Nut. Where are you from, really? The old panic contained again. Be harmless, be helpful, make friends, lie. But how did you lie to friends? I must go, he said, scurrying down the stone steps. Mr. Trev will be waiting. Nice but odd, Glenda thought, watching him leap down the steps. Clever, too, to spot my scarf on a hook 10 yards away. The sound of a rattling tin can alerted Nut to his boss's presence before he'd even hurried through the old archway to the vats. The other habitués had paused in their work, which, frankly, given its usual snail-like progress, meant hardly any change at all, and were watching him listlessly. But they were watching, at least. Even Concrete looked vaguely alert, but Nut saw a little dribble of brown in the corner of his mouth. Someone had been giving him iron filings again. The can shot up as Trev caught it with his boot, flew over his head and then came back obliquely, as if rolling down an invisible slope, and landed in his waiting hand. There was a murmur of appreciation from the watchers, and Concrete banged his hand on the table, which generally meant approval. "What kept you, Gobbo? Chatting up Glenda, were you? You've got no chance there, take it from me. Been there, tried that, oh yeah. No chance, mate." He threw a grubby bag towards Nut. "Get these on quick, else you'll stand out like a diamond in—" "A sweep's ear hole?" Nut suggested. "Yeah, you're getting it. Now don't hang about, or we'll be late." Nut looked doubtfully at a very long scarf in pink and green, and a large yellow woolly hat with a pink bobble on it. "Pull it down hard so it covers your ears," Trev commanded. "Get a move on." "Pink," said Nut doubtfully, holding up the scarf. "What about it? Well, isn't football a rough man's game, whereas pink, if you'll excuse me, is rather a female colour?" Trev grinned. "Yeah, that's right. Think about it. You are the clever one round here. And you can walk and think at the same time, I know that. Makes you stand out from the crowd in these parts." "Ah, I think I have it. The pink proclaims an almost belligerent masculinity, saying, as it does, I'm so masculine I can afford to tempt you to question it, giving me the opportunity to proclaim it anew by doing violence to you in response. I don't know if you have ever read Offelberger's Die Wesentlichen Ungewissheiten zugehörig der offenkundigen Männlichkeit." Trev grabbed his shoulder and spun him round. "What do you think, Gobbo?" he said, his red face a couple of inches from Nut's. "What is your problem? What are you all about? You come out with $10 words and you lay 'em down like a man doing a jigsaw. So how come you're down in the vats, eh, working for someone like me? It don't make sense. Are you on the run from the old Sam? No problem there, unless you did up an old lady or something, but you've got to tell me." "Too dangerous," thought Nut desperately. "Change the subject." "She's called Juliet," he gasped. "The girl you asked about. She lives next door to Glenda. Honestly." Trev looked suspicious. "Glenda told you that?" "Yes. She was winding you up. She knew you'd tell me." "I don't think she would lie to me, Mr. Trev. She is my friend." "I kept thinking about her all last night," said Trev. "Well, she is a wonderful cook," Nut agreed. "I meant Juliet."
And Glenda said to tell you that Juliet's other name is Stollop," said Nut, hating to be the bearer of worse news.
"What? That girl is a Stollop?"
"Yes. Glenda said I was to see how you liked that, but I know the meaning of irony."
"Bah, it's like finding a strawberry in a dog meat stew, yeah? I mean, the Stollops are buggers, the lot of them. Biters and cloggers to a man, the kind of bastards who kick your family jewels up into your throat.
But you don't play football, do you? You just watch."
"Damn right, but I'm a face, right? I'm known in all the boroughs. You can ask anyone. Everyone knows Trev Likely. I'm Dave Likely's lad. Every supporter in the city knows about him. 4 goals. No one else scored that much in a lifetime. And gave as good as he got, did Dad. One game, he picked up the dolly bastard holding the ball and threw him over the line. He gave as good as he got, my Dad, and then some."
"So he was a bugger and a clogger and a biter too, was he?"
"What? Are you pulling my tonker?"
"I would not wish to do so initially, Mr. Trev," said Nut, so solemnly that Trev had to grin. "But, you see, if he fought the opposing team with even more force than they used, does that not mean that he—"
"He was my dad,"
said Trev. That means you don't try any fancy maths, OK?
OK, indeed.
And you never wanted to follow in his footsteps?
What,
and get brung home on a stretcher? I got my brains from my old mum, not from my dad. He was a good bloke and loved his football, but he wasn't flush with brains to start with, and on that day, some of them were leaking out of his ear. The dollies got him in the melee and sorted him out good and proper. That's not for me, Gobbo. I'm smart.
Yes, Mr. Trev, I can see that.
Get the gear on. Let's go, OK? We don't want to miss anything.
Thing, said Nut automatically, as he started to wind the huge scarf around his neck.
What?
Said Trev, frowning.
What?
Said Nut, his voice a little muffled. There was a lot of scarf. It was almost covering his mouth.
Are you pulling my chuff, Gobbo?
Said Trev, handing him an ancient sweater, faded and saggy with age.
Please, Mr. Trev, I don't know. There appears to be so much I might inadvertently pull.
He tugged on the big woolly hat with the pink pom-pom on it.
They are so very pink, Mr. Trev. We must be bursting with machismo. I don't know what you personally are bursting with, Gobbo, but here's something to learn. Come on, if you think you're hard enough.
Now you say it.
Come on, if you think you're hard enough, said Nut obediently.
Well, okay, said Trev, inspecting him.
Just remember, if anyone starts pushing you around during the game and giving you grief, just you say that to them and they'll see you're wearing the dimmer colours and they'll think twice, got it?
Nut, somewhere in the space between the big bobbly hat and the boa constrictor of a scarf, nodded.
Wow, there you are, Gobbo, a complete fan. Your own mother wouldn't recognise you.
There was a pause before a voice emerged from inside the mound of ancient woolens, which looked very much like a nursery layette made by a couple of giants who weren't sure what to expect.
I believe you are accurate. Yeah? Well, that's good, innit? Now let's go and meet the lads. Move fast, stay close.
Now remember, this is a pre-season friendly between the Angels and the Whoppers, right? Said Trev as they stepped out into a fine rain, which, because of Ankh-Morpork's standing cloud of pollution, was morphing gently into smog.
They're both pretty crap. They'll never amount to anything, but the Dimmers shout for the Angels, right?
It took some explaining, but the core of it, as far as Nut could understand it, was this. All football teams in the city were rated by Dimwell in proportion to their closeness, physical, psychological or general gut feeling, to the hated Dolly Sisters. It had just evolved that way. If you went to a match between two other teams, you automatically, according to some complex and ever-changing ready reckoner of love and hate, cheered the team most nearly allied to your native turf, or, more accurately, cobbles.
Do you see what I mean? Trev finished.
I have committed what you said to memory, Mr. Trev.
Oh, brother, and I bet you have at that. And it's just Trev when we're not at work, right? We shout together, right?
He punched Nut playfully on the arm.
Why did you do that, Mr. Trev? Said Nut.
His eyes, almost the only part of him visible, looked hurt.
You struck me. That wasn't me hitting you, Gobbo. That was just a friendly punch. Big difference. Don't you know that? It's a little tap on the arm to show we're mates. Go on, do it to me. Go on.
Trev winked. You will be polite, and most of all, you will never raise your hand in anger to anyone. But this wasn't like that, was it? Nut asked himself. Trev was his friend. This was friendly. A friend thing. He punched the friendly arm.
That was a punch? Said Trev. You call that a punch? A girl could punch better than that. How come you're still alive with a weedy punch like that? Go on! Try a proper punch.
Nut did. Be one of the crowd. It went against everything a wizard stood for, and a wizard would not stand for anything if he could sit down for it. But even sitting down, you had to stand out. There were, of course, times when a robe got in the way. Especially when a wizard was working in his forge, creating a magic metal, or mobiloid glass, or any of those other little exercises in practical magic, where not setting fire to yourself is a happy bonus. So every wizard had some leather trousers and a stained, rotted-by-acid shirt. It was the shared, dirty little secret. Not very secret, but ingrained with deep-down dirt. Ridcully sighed. His colleagues had aimed for the look of the common man, but had only a hazy grasp of what the common man looked like these days. And now they were sniggering and looking at one another and saying things like, "Cor blimey, don't you scrub down well, as it were, my old mate." Beside them, and looking extremely embarrassed, were two of the university's Bledlows, not knowing what to do with their feet and wishing that they were having a quiet smoke somewhere in the warm.
"Gentlemen," Ridcully began, and then, with a gleam in his eye, added, "Or should I say, fellow workers by hand and brain, this afternoon we—"
"Yes, Senior Wrangler." "Are we, in point of fact, workers? This is a university, after all," said the senior wrangler.
"I agree with the senior wrangler," said the lecturer in recent runes. "Under university statute, we are specifically forbidden to engage, other than within college precincts, in any magic above level 4, unless specifically asked to do so by the civil power, or, under clause 3, we really want to. We are acting as placeholders, and as such, forbidden from working."
"Would you accept slackers by hand and brain?" said Ridcully, always happy to see how far he could go.
"Slackers by hand and brain by statute," said the senior wrangler, primly.
Ridcully gave up. He could do this all day, but life couldn't be all fun.
"That being settled, then, I must tell you that I have asked the stalwart Mr. Frankly Ottomy and Mr. Alf Nobbs to join us in this little escapade. Mr. Nobbs says that since we are not wearing football favours, we should not attract unwanted attention."
The wizards nodded nervously at the Bledlows. They were, of course, merely employees of the university, while the wizards were, well, were the university, weren't they? After all, a university was not just about bricks and mortar. It was about people, specifically wizards. But to a man, the Bledlows scared them. They were all hefty men, with a look of having been carved out of bacon. And they were all descendants of, and practically identical to, those men who had chased those wizards, younger and more limber, and it was amazing how fast you could run with a couple of Bledlows behind you through the foggy nighttime streets. If caught, said Bledlows, who took enormous pleasure in the prosecution of the university's private laws and idiosyncratic rules, would then drag you before the Arch-Chancellor on a charge of attempting to become rascally drunk. That was preferable to fighting back, when the Bledlows were widely believed to take the opportunity for a little class warfare. That was years ago, but even now the unexpected sight of a Bledlow caused sullen, shameful terror to flow down the spines of men who had acquired more letters after their names than a game of Scrabble. Mr. Ottomy, recognising this, leered and touched the brim of his uniform cap.
"Afternoon, gents," he said. "Don't you worry about a thing. Me and Elf here will see you rate. We'd better get moving, though. They bully off in half an hour."
The senior wrangler would not have been the senior wrangler if he did not hate the sound of silence. As they shuffled out the back door, wincing at the unfamiliar chafing of trouser upon knee, he turned to Mr. Nobbs and said,
"Nobbs, that's not a common name. Tell me, Alf, are you by any chance related to the famous Corporal Nobby Nobbs the Watch?"
Mr. Nobbs took it well, Ridcully thought, given the clumsy lack of protocol.
"No, sir." "Ah, a distant branch of the name, then." "No, sir. Different tree."
In the greyness of her front room, Glenda looked at the suitcase and despaired. She'd done her best with brown boot polish week after week, but it had been bought from a shonky shop, and the cardboard under the leatherish exterior was beginning to show through. Her customers never seemed to notice, but she did, even when it was out of sight. It was a secret part of a secret life that she lived for an hour or two on her half-day off once a week, and maybe a little longer if today's cold calls worked out. She looked at her face in the mirror and said, in a voice that was full of jaunt, "We all know the problem of underarm defoliation. It is so hard, isn't it, to keep the lichens healthy. But," she flourished a green and blue container with a golden stopper, "one spray with Verdant Spring will keep those crevices moist and forest fresh all day long." She faltered, because it really wasn't her. She couldn't do jaunty. The stuff was a dollar a bottle. Who could afford that? Well, a lot of troll ladies, that's who. But Mr. Strong in the Arm said it was okay because they had the money. And anyway, it did let the moss grow. She'd said all right, but a dollar for a fancy bottle of water with some plant food in it was a bit steep. And he'd said, "You are selling the dream." And they bought it. That was the worrying part. They bought it and recommended it to their friends. The city had discovered the heavy dollar now. She'd read about it in the paper. There had always been trolls around, doing the heavy lifting and generally being there in the background, if not being the actual background itself. But now they were raising families and running businesses, moving on and up and buying things, and that made them people at last. And so you got other people like Mr. Strong in the Arm, a dwarf, selling beauty products to Miss and Mrs. Troll via ladies like Glenda, a human, because although dwarfs and trolls were officially great chums these days, because of something called the Coombe Valley Accord, that sort of thing only meant much to the sort of people who signed treaties.
Even the most well-intentioned dwarf would not walk down some of the roads along which Glenda, every week, dragged her nasty, semi-cardboard case, selling the dream. It got her out of the house and paid for the little treats. There was money to put away for a rainy day. Mr. Strong in the Arm had the knack of coming up with new ideas, too. Who would have thought that Lady Trolls would go for fake tan lotion? It sold. Everything sold. The dream sold. And it was shallow and expensive and made her feel cheap. Her ever-straining ears caught the sound of next door's front door opening very slowly. Ha! Juliet jumped as Glenda suddenly loomed beside her. Off somewhere? Gonna watch the game, ain't I? Glenda glanced up the street. A figure was disappearing rapidly around the corner. She grinned, a grim grin. Oh, yes, good idea. I wasn't doing anything. Just wait while I fetch my scarf, will you? To herself, she added, you just keep walking, Johnny. With a thump that caused pigeons to explode away like a detonating daisy, the librarian landed on his chosen rooftop. He liked football. Something about the shouting and the fighting appealed to his ancestral memories. And this was fascinating because, strictly speaking, his ancestors had been blamelessly engaged for centuries as upstanding corn and feed merchants, and, moreover, were allergic to heights. He sat down on the parapet with his feet over the edge, and his nostrils flared as he snuffed up the scents rising from below. It is said that the onlooker sees most of the game, but the librarian could smell as well, and the game, seen from outside, was humanity. Not a day went past without his thanking the magical accident that had moved him a few little genes away from it. Apes had it worked out. No ape would philosophize. The mountain is and is not. They would think, the banana is. I will eat the banana. There is no banana. I want another banana. He peeled one now, in a preoccupied way, while watching the evolving tableau below. Not only does said onlooker see most of the game, he might even see more than one game. This street was indeed a crescent, which would probably have an effect on tactics if the players had any truck with such high-flown concepts. People were pouring in from either end, and also from a couple of alleyways. Mostly they were male, extremely so. The women fell into two categories. Those who had been tugged there by the ties of blood or prospective matrimony, after which they could stop pretending that this bloody mess was in any way engrossing, and a number of elderly women of a sweet old lady construction who bawled indiscriminately in a rising cloud of lavender and peppermint screams of "Get him down and kick him in the nuts!" and similar exhortations. And there was another smell now, one he'd learned to recognise but could not quite fathom. It was the smell of nut. Tangled with it were the smells of tallow, cheap soap and shonky shop clothing that the ape part of him categorised as belonging to tin-flinging man. He had been just another servant in the maze of the university, but now he was a friend of Nut, and Nut was important. He was also wrong. He had no place in the world, but he was in it, and the world was becoming aware of him soon enough. The librarian knew all about this sort of thing. There had been no space in the fabric of reality marked Simeon Librarian until he'd been dropped into one, and the ripples had made his life a very strange one. Ah, another scent was riding the gentle updraft. It was Easy, screaming banana pie woman. The librarian liked her. Oh, she had screamed and run away the first time she'd seen him. They all did, but she had come back, and she'd smelled ashamed. She also respected the primacy of words, and, as a primate, so did he. And sometimes she baked him a banana pie, which was a kind act. The librarian was not very familiar with love, which had always struck him as a bit ethereal and soppy. But kindness, on the other hand, was practical. You knew where you were with kindness, especially if you were holding a pie it had just given you. She was a friend of Nut, too. Nut made friends easily for someone who had come from nowhere. Interesting. The librarian, despite appearances, liked order. Books about cabbages went on the brassica shelves, brackets on, blit, brackets off, UUSS, FY890-9046, brackets on, anti-blit 1.1, brackets off, although, obviously, Mr. Cauliflower's Big Adventure would be better placed in UUSS J3.2, brackets on, blit, brackets off, 9, While the Tau of Cabbage would certainly be a candidate for UUSS, brackets on Blitz Plus, brackets off, 60-SP55-09-HL, brackets on Blitz, brackets off. To anyone familiar with a seven-dimensional library system in Blitz dimensional space, it was as clear as daylight. If you remembered to keep your eye on the Blitz. Ah, and here came his fellow wizards, walking awkwardly in the chafing trousers and trying so hard not to stand out in the crowd that they would have stood out even more if the rest of the crowd had been the least bit interested. Nobody noticed. It was enthralling and exciting at the same time, Ridcully concluded. Normally the pointy hat, robe and staff cleared the way faster than a troll with an axe. They were being pushed and shoved, but it was not as unpleasant as the words suggested. There were moderate pressures on all sides as people poured in behind, as though the wizards were standing chest deep in the sea and were swaying and shifting to the slow rhythm of the tide. "My goodness," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. "Is this football? It's a bit dull, isn't it?" "Pies were mentioned," said the lecturer in recent runes, craning his neck. "People are still coming in, Gov," said Otomie. "But however do we see things?" "Depends on the shove, Gov. Usually people near the action shout out." "Ah, I see a pie cellar," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. He took a couple of steps forward. There was a random shift and sway in the crowd, and he vanished. "How is it now, Mr. Trev?" said Nut, as people surged around them. "It's like buggery, excuse my clatchian," muttered Trev, clutching his injured arm to his coat. "Are you sure you weren't holding an hammer?" "No hammer, Mr. Trev. I'm sorry, but you did ask me." "I know, I know. Where did you learn to punch like that?"
"Never learned, Mr. Trev. I must never raise my hand to another person, but you went on so, and...
I mean, you're so skinny."
"Long bones, Mr. Trev, long muscles. I really am very sorry."
"My fault, Gobbo, I didn't know your own strength." Suddenly Trev shot forward, cannoning into Nut.
"Where have you been, my man?" said the person who had just slapped him hard on the back. "We said to meet at the eel pie stall."
Now the speaker looked at Nut and his eyes narrowed.
"And who's this stranger who thinks he's one of us?"
He did not exactly glare at Nut, but there was a definite sense of a weighing in the balance, and on unfriendly scales. Trev brushed himself off, looking uncharacteristically embarrassed.
"Hi, Andy. This is Nut. He works for me."
"What, as a bog brush?" said Andy.
There was laughter from the group behind him. Andy always got a laugh. It was the first thing you noticed, after the glint in his eye.
"Andy's dad is Captain of Dimwell, Gobbo."
"Pleased to meet you, sir," said Nut, extending a hand.
"Oh, pleased to meet you, sir,"
Andy mimicked, and Trev grimaced as a calloused hand the size of a plate grasped Nut's cheese straw fingers.
"He's got hands like a girl," Andy observed, taking a grip.
"Mr. Trev has been telling me wonderful things about the Dimmers, sir," said Nut.
Andy grunted. Trev saw his knuckles whiten with effort while Nut chattered.
"The camaraderie of the sport must be a wonderful thing."
"Yeah, right,"
Andy grunted, finally managing to pull his hand away, his face full of angry puzzlement.
"And this is my mate Maxie," said Trev quickly, "and this is Carter the Farter."
"That's the Fartmeister now," said Carter.
"Yeah, right, and this is Jumbo. You want to watch out for him, he's a thief. Jumbo can pick a lock faster than you can pick your nose."
The said Jumbo held up a small bronze badge.
"Guild, of course," he said. "They nail your ears to the door, else."
"You mean you break the law for a living?" said Nut, horrified.
"Ain't you ever heard of the Thieves' Guild?" said Andy.
"Gobbo's new," said Trev protectively. "Hasn't got out much. He's a goblin from the High Country."
"Coming down here, taking our jobs, yeah?"
said Carter.
"Like, how often do you do Anne's turn?" said Trev.
"Well, I might want to one day."
"Milking the cows when they come home," said Andy.
This got another laugh on cue. And that was the introduction sorted out, to Nut's surprise. He'd been expecting chicken theft to be mentioned. Instead, Carter pulled a couple of tin cans out of a pocket and tossed them to Nut and Trev.
"Did a few hours unloading down the docks, didn't I?"
he said defensively, as though a bit of casual labour was some kind of offence.
"This come off a boat from 4X.
Jumbo fished in his pocket again and pulled out someone else's watch.
"Game on in 5 minutes," he declared. "Let's shove. If that's all right with you, Andy?"
Andy nodded. Jumbo looked relieved. It was always important that things were all right with Andy, and Andy was still watching Nut as a cat watches an unexpectedly cheeky mouse while massaging his hand. Mr. Otomie cleared his throat, causing his red Adam's apple to bob up and down like an indecisive sunset. Shouting in public, yes, he liked that. He was good at that. Speaking in public now, that was a different kettle of humiliation.
Well, gents, what we will have here is your actual football, what is basically about the shove, which is what you gentlemen will be doing soon.
I thought we watched two groups of players vie with one another to get the ball in the opponent's goal.
Could be, sir, could very much be, de Bledlow conceded. But in the streets, see, your actual supporters on both sides try and endeavour to shorten the length of the field, as it were, depending on the flow of play, so to speak.
Like living walls, do you mean? Said Ridcully.
That style of thing, sir, yes, sir, said Otomie loyally.
What about the goals?
Oh, they're allowed to move the goals too.
Sorry, said Ponder. The spectators can move the goals?
You have put your finger firmly on it, sir.
But that's sheer anarchy. It's a mess.
Some of the old boys do say the game has gone downhill, sir. That is true.
Downhill, into and out through the bottom of the world, I'd say.
Good one to play with magic, though, said Dr. Hicks. Well worth a try.
A word to the wise, sir, said Otomie with unwitting accuracy, but you'd be wearing your guts for garters if you trade it with some of the types who play these days. They take it seriously.
Mr. Otomie, I'm sure none of my blokes wear garters.
Ridcully stopped and listened to Ponder Stibbons's whispered interjection and continued,
Well, possibly one, two at most, and it would be a very dull world if we were all the same. That's what I say.
He looked around and shrugged.
So, this is football, is it? Rather a wizened shell of a game, yes? I, for one, don't want to stand around all day in the rain while other people have all the fun. Let's go and find the ball, gentlemen. We are wizards. That must count for something.
I thought we were blokes now, said the lecturer in recent rooms.
Same thing, said Ridcully, straining to see over the heads of the crowd.
Surely not.
Well, said Ridcully, isn't a bloke someone who likes drinking with his mates and without the company of women? Anyway, I'm fed up with this. Form up behind me, nevertheless. We're going to see some football.
The progress of the wizards astonished Otomie and Nobbs, who had hitherto seen them as fluffy, plump creatures quite divorced from real life. But to get to be a senior wizard and stay there called for deep reserves of determination, viciousness, and the sugared arrogance that is the mark of every true gentleman. As in, oh, was that your foot? I'm so terribly sorry. And, of course, there was Dr. Hicks, a good man to have in a tight spot because he was, by college statute, an officially bad person, in accordance with UU's happy grasp of the inevitable. In short, every wizard knew that, whatever you did, you'd get some wizards creeping off to do weird and messy magic in some cave somewhere. A less mature organisation than UU might have taken the view that the way forward would be to hunt such renegades down, at great risk and expense. UU, on the other hand, had given Hicks and his team a department, and a budget, and a career structure, and also the chance to go out into dark caves occasionally and throw fireballs at unofficial evil wizards. It all worked rather well, so long as nobody pointed out that the Department of Post-Mortem Communications was really, when you got right down to it, just a politer form of NECROMANCY, wasn't it? And so Dr. Hicks was now tolerated as a useful, if slightly irritating, member of the council, largely because he was allowed, by statute, to say some of the naughty things that other wizards would really have liked to say themselves. Someone with a widow's peak, a skull ring, a sinister staff and a black robe was expected to spread a little evil round the place, although university statute had redefined acceptable evil in this case as being inconveniences on a par with shoelaces tied together or a brief attack of groinal itch. It wasn't the most satisfactory of arrangements, but it was in the best UU tradition. Hicks occupied, amiably, a niche that might otherwise be occupied by someone who really got off on the whole mouldering corpses and peeled skulls thing. Admittedly, he was always giving fellow wizards free tickets to the various amateur dramatic productions he was obsessively involved with, but on balance, they agreed, taking one thing with another, this was still better than peeled skulls. For Hicks, a crowd like this was too good to waste. Not only was there a plethora of bootlaces to be expertly tied together, but there were an awful lot of pockets as well.
he always had some flyers for the next production in his robe. Hicks had flatly refused to wear trousers. No self-respecting dark wizard would dream of wearing such common garb as a trouser, he declared. It totally spoiled the effect. And it wasn't the same as picking pockets. Quite the reverse. He stuffed them into